But it's been really good hearing your perspective, and maybe we'll talk again sooner this time.
That'd be great. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, we really appreciate it. Again, that's Corey Morningstar, blogger with Wrong Kind of Green, who's written a long series of exposés of what is called the nonprofit industrial complex and the reality behind the smokescreen of the new economy, the green economy, these large-scale attempts to redress climate change, etc. But we got to go. So thank you so much for listening. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. My name is Paul Rowland.
Talk about destruction. Don't you know you can count me? In, out, all right.
It's 9 o'clock. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. And here what we have, here's what we have coming up for you this morning on KBOO. First, on Political Perspectives, host Martin Dodge speaks with Joe Peary, a friend of Reverend Edward Pinckney, a community activist from Benton Harbor, Michigan. Pinckney is currently serving a 10-year prison sentence for allegedly changing the dates next to some signatures on a recall petition for the mayor of Benton Harbor. At 9:30, Kristen Yount interviews Michael Gould Wartofsky about his new book, The Occupiers, The Making of the 99% Movement. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. And then at 10:15, we've got Flashpoints. Today, historic elections in Burma. Also, low-wage fast food workers walk out in support of a $15 an hour minimum wage. And also an update on the recent presidential elections in Haiti. And at 11 o'clock, it's the Dirt Bag with Glenn Andreessen and Jim Gilbert today talking about growing nuts in Western Oregon. They also discuss blooming plants to brighten your way as the days become shorter. And thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a member, now's a great time to become one when you go to kboo.fm/support. Stay tuned for Political Perspectives.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Pollinating Rios Vivos, Thursday, November 12th, 7 p.m. at Reed's Volum Lecture Hall in Portland. The Beehive Design Collective will talk about how storytelling and art is used while building solidarity with Rios Vivos, Colombia, the social movement of dam-impacted communities that struggle for the defense of their territories and rivers and for an energy model by and for the people. Again, that's Pollinating Rios Vivos on Thursday, November 12th, 7 p.m. at the Volum Lecture Hall on the Reed College campus, 3203 Southeast Woodstock in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Well, buzz, buzz, buzz goes
the
bumblebee.
The fate of a 66-year-old black man, the Reverend Edward Pinckney, who was serving a long and probably unjust term in a Michigan prison, is closely tied to the story of the town he comes from, Benton Harbor, Michigan. It was once a prosperous town of 20,000, a manufacturing hub on the shore of Lake Michigan between Chicago and Grand Rapids. Joe Peary in Chicago is a friend of Reverend Pinckney and also a member of his national defense team.
I sit on the National Defense Committee. And he had called me a while back, asked me to be a, this is way back, to be a spokesman when he first was going to trial about this. I first actually heard about his case in Los Angeles. Heard about it on the Margaret Prescott Show, KPFK Radio, and I was actually flabbergasted from what I heard. This was back in about 2000 and maybe 6 or 7. And later on I moved to Chicago. I'm actually from here, so I just moving back. And I had a chance to go up to Benton Harbor in about 2009 and 2010. I've been back several times. And I've been helping Reverend Pinckney during that time with a lot of the organizing and a lot of the, you know, a lot of the light he was trying to shed upon what was happening in Benton Harbor.
Today, as another victim of Michigan's economic collapse, by any measure, Benton Harbor, not Detroit, is the poorest city in Michigan. More than half of the population is on welfare. Its population is down to about 10,000, 90% African American, thanks to white flight. Benton Harbor's slide into poverty was detailed in the New York Times 4 years ago. Its government had been taken over by the state, making it a favorite subject for Rachel Maddow and Stephen Colbert for poverty, joblessness, and that anti-democratic business of it having been taken over by the state's Republican regime. There was also the fact that a very big corporation, the third largest in Michigan, and the only one left in Benton Harbor, Whirlpool Corporation, was the gorilla in the room when it came to what went down in the town. It had a lot to say. Too much, some critics said, among them the Reverend Edward Pinckney.
This is all coming from the Whirlpool Corporation, who, you know, and you take a place like Benton Harbor, it's very, very small, so you can see a microcosm of what's really happening in America. But they're the employer, the main employer. They lay everybody off permanently. Once they do that, they don't really need the people of Benton Harbor anymore. So it's like, get out. And you have these leaders like Reverend Pinckney and others who have come forward and saying, no, enough is enough. You can't mistreat people.
The great migration of black citizens from the Depression-era South in the 1930s brought a social revolution to southeast Michigan and Benton Harbor. Black people came by the thousands to manufacturing centers like Detroit and Benton Harbor seeking work. The migration changed demographics radically. Detroit may have been the Motor City, but now it was also Motown. Southern racism managed to follow job-seeking blacks north, however. Racist hate groups like the KKK are still in existence. Pinckney, a leader in his city's struggle for social and economic justice, organized the Benton Harbor black community to confront racism after crossburners began holding rallies in the 1990s. Racial tensions have abated somewhat, and now Pinckney believes the race war has turned into a class war that pits the rich against the poor and drags down the working class in Michigan, black and white alike.
And you know, see, the real story here is not Reverend Pinckney or this or that person. It's what's happening to the little people. You know, Reverend Pinckney is important because Reverend Pinckney stepped forward and he started to become the voice for the homeless, for the people on the bottom, for the destitute, you know, and he always preached, you know, change had to happen from the bottom up, not the top down. And this is what they're so upset at him about. You know, that's the real issue here.
By the millennium, conditions in Benton Harbor had become very bad. The Michigan Treasury Department in 2009 sent a team to look into the impoverished town's finances. The report came back saying the city was badly mismanaged. Its city pension fund was short by $10 million, for example, and budget deficits kept building. By 2011, acting under emergency legislation, the state appointed a manager to effectively take over the running of the town's government. The manager found that budgeting was so bad in Benton Harbor that it was incurring overdraft fees of as much as $100,000 a year. It owed the Internal Revenue Service $678,000 in back taxes and HUD more than $1 million for a loan that had been distributed to three local businesses, all of which had gone bankrupt, leaving the city holding the bag. Now, with the manager in control, the elected town council could do little else than hold short, meaningless meetings. Now, the town is still run by the appointed manager, isn't it? Or has that changed? Yeah.
You know, and to be honest with you, I'm not sure where. I know they fought off over a period of time the whatever influence the emergency managers had. They were able to cut back on it somehow.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not sure how far the emergency manager's power goes as compared to a city council and a mayor. But I know in general, in a place like Michigan, where now they started out with emergency managers in Benton Harbor, and now, and supposedly when they started out, it was like, well, you know, the undercurrent of the thinking was, well, it's a black thing, and they're so corrupt in Benton Harbor, we got to send these emergency managers. Now there's emergency managers all over Michigan, and most of them are in areas where it's mostly whites that live, you know. And so here they start out with, you know, sort of playing the race card in order to get the thing going. And to show you how unpopular it is, there was a vote a few years ago where the voters unanimously voted, you know, voted it out, get rid of this emergency manager thing. No sooner did they vote it out, and the legislature and the government, and I'm sorry, the governor, put in another emergency manager act that's even worse than the original one. And with this one, you can't vote them out. You can't make a referendum and vote them out. So the will of the people in Michigan is never, you know, it's never met.
Yeah.
I think this is the message for the rest of the country. If they're doing this in Michigan, they can do it, you know, out in Oregon, California, wherever. And you're seeing versions of this emergency manager thing going on all over the country. They tried to introduce them in New Jersey. They're talking about something similar to that in Baltimore. I've heard, you know, in dealing with the issue of water out in California. So, you know, this is a story really for the rest of the country. It's not just, you know, a horror story going on in Benton Harbor.
Isn't that law tested in court? Didn't somebody take it to court?
You know, I'm not really sure. I wouldn't doubt it. But higher than a court is when you take it to a referendum and the people vote on it. And like something like 70% of the people in Michigan voted it out.
Now, with the new law, can they do that again, or is that prohibited?
Well, my understanding is, and you'll have to speak to somebody up there maybe, but my understanding is, no, you can't do another referendum and vote this one out.
Well,
I don't know what they did to make that happen, but that's what they've done.
Uh-huh. What does a desperately poor city do to rebuild a collapsed manufacturing economy? I'm sure any responsible man or woman would come to the same conclusion. You've got to build a golf course. That's what was decided for Benton Harbor. Several nonprofit corporations, all of them the creatures of the Whirlpool Corporation, obtained federal and state grant money. They applied it to building an upscale resort community in Benton Harbor centered on a PGA-class golf course. The New York Times in 2011 called Harbor Shores at Lake Michigan a monument to wealth plopped into the massive squalor that was Benton Harbor. A reporter said it looked like the kind of situation you might find in a tourist resort built in a down-at-the-heels Caribbean island nation. Meanwhile, substantial tax breaks encouraged Whirlpool to put up a new $68 million headquarters building for its executives and knowledge workers. It had long ago moved all its manufacturing to overseas factories and elsewhere, taking advantage of cheap, non-union labor. The company has worldwide sales of $19 billion in home appliances under its own label, as well as the names of those companies it has absorbed: Maytag, Amana, and KitchenAid. Whirlpool, covering itself with offshore tax protection, has long paid no income taxes to the federal government or to the state of Michigan.
You know, this thing of crime. I mean, they're criminalizing the homeless, they're criminalizing everybody. Is anybody, you know, twisting and turning around and saying, well, how about the criminality happening on the other side? Because once, you know, an employer, for whatever reason, lays people off permanently, you've literally destroyed a community. And that's what's happening in Benton Harbor. And so the little people are trying to survive, and, you know, the people with the power and the money, basically Whirlpool, they're putting the people under a lot of duress. It's basically, get out of here. We don't want you anymore. We don't need you. Get out. I mean, it's a version of how do you take public money, taxpayer money, and channel it toward these private, you know, corporate structures. And that's pretty much what we're, and of course, nobody's up there is going to take Whirlpool to task. They're not going to do it. You know, Berrien County is Whirlpool's thiefdom. You know, nobody is going to arrest them, challenge them, take them to court about any of that.
The gated Harbor Shores Homes community, built adjacent to the golf course, had the main purpose of providing housing for executives hired to work for Whirlpool. Prices on the homes, upward of $300,000, went far beyond the average annual income, pegged at $10,000 for Black Benton Harbor citizens. Whirlpool claims it could easily have moved its facilities elsewhere, but believes it has a deep commitment to Benton Harbor. It has donated millions of dollars toward improving the city's schools, several hundreds of thousands of dollars to build and support a Boys and Girls Club, and has built a training facility to teach underprivileged kids the game of golf. It has also contributed towards converting a downtown area into an arts district. But it has never explained how the gated homes and the golf course will benefit the poor Black population of Benton Harbor. The only jobs those developments will create for the city's semi-skilled workers would be minimum wage service work, cleaning houses, mowing lawns, carrying golf clubs, or servicing hotel rooms, and there would not be that many of those jobs either. Those suspicious of Whirlpool's intentions, such as Pinckney, say that the corporation, through a group of nonprofits it created, scooped up federal and state money intended to help the people of Benton Harbor, directing it to projects that would benefit the corporation, not the city. They also believe the state was a party to ripping off the city in, for example, the case of Harbor Shores. The state put millions of dollars into Harbor Shores and gave Whirlpool nearly $20 million in tax credits to build its new headquarters on that land. A major issue of contention is a 22-acre chunk of public land donated to the city for use as a public park.
Given to the city, you know, like 100 years ago, and the guy who gave that land to the city wanted it to be forever a park, a public park, only for the citizens of Benton Harbor. But somehow through this emergency manager thing, they've been able to steal that park from the people and turn it into a, you know, an elite signature Jack Nicklaus golf course. And it was Reverend Pinckney who, you know, with the people who marched down on the place and made it a big national, you know, scene. You know, the rich people do not like this. They come down on you like a ton of bricks.
It ended up instead incorporated into the resort golf course. On the excuse of its desperate need for income, Benton Harbor's government leased the parkland to Harbor Shores for 105 years, starting at $35,000 a year. If you buy the proponents' arguments, the deal represented a repurposing of a scrubby stretch of little-used lakefront property. If you suspect Whirlpool of evil intent, it was an underhanded violation of the public trust. Reverend Pinckney took the latter view. For him, the deal provided the incentive to begin circulating a petition to recall then-Mayor James Hightower, another Black man. Pinckney believed Hightower had played footsie with the Whirlpool Corporation to push the land deal through, also claiming Hightower further violated his duty to the public by being in opposition to forcing Whirlpool to pay what many considered would be a fair share of local taxes. Pinckney and others believe Whirlpool long ago decided to take over and redesign the town to better serve its interests, currying favor with some town officials toward that area. Pinckney and others believe Whirlpool long ago decided to take over and redesign the town to better serve its interests, currying favor with some town officials toward that end. Before petitioning to recall the mayor, Pinckney had been involved in a number of actions involving Whirlpool and city officials. He organized, for instance, an occupation of the Harbor Shores golf course during a national tournament. His petition died automatically when the criminal charges were filed against him.
First of all, Reverend Pinckney had gotten enough signatures on the recall petition to recall the mayor anyway. And a judge had weighed in and said, "Yeah, go ahead with the recall." This is the second time they put aside a recall election in that city under the same circumstances. They were trying to derail the recall by, you know, inventing a Reverend Pinckney case.
The state claimed Pinckney had altered signatures and dates on his petition, even though the people who signed the petition said the signatures were indeed their own, and that any dates changed had been changed by them. A state forensics expert for the prosecution testified it is impossible to determine who it was who may have changed a few dates, or when it was done, or even, for that matter, if it happened at all. A city commissioner who signed the petition, Mary Alice Adams, testified that it was not Pinckney who had changed the date by her signature. She said she herself had changed it after realizing she had originally entered an incorrect date. The jury rejected Adams' testimony. Nonetheless, the jury was urged by the prosecutor to believe that direct evidence was not required, that they only had to believe that Pinckney had the motivation and the opportunity to cheat. The trial stretched on for 5 days, during which no witness testified to seeing Pinckney change any dates or signatures on the recall petition. During his opening argument, the prosecutor indeed made a prediction to the jury that they would not hear anyone say that they witnessed the defendant engaging in fraud. Witness after witness stood up to the prosecutor, who not only accused Pinckney, but also questioned his community organization. The prosecutor pressed one witness after another to confess that dates were altered. Lacking affirmative responses, and irrelevant to the case, he questioned each concerning whether or not they were members of BANCO, the social justice group Pinckney headed. Pinckney is now serving the first year of a possible 10-year sentence, given a felony sentence on what would ordinarily be considered a misdemeanor charge. He was convicted by a white jury on the basis of what his defense team said was little or no real evidence. "We've got to fix this jury system," Pinckney says. "There was not one person from Benton Harbor, not one person from Benton Township on the jury that convicted him." Pinckney supporters accuse a white female juror of perjury. They say that during jury qualification, she said she had no ties to any of the principals in the case. They say she is not only a friend of two members of the prosecution team, but also their longtime work colleague. It has also been said there was a confirmed racist seated on the jury. The judge says he issued a stiff sentence because Pinckney had a previous conviction for assault with a dangerous weapon in California, and because he had been charged with theft and embezzlement elsewhere. These charges were additional to an earlier voter fraud case in Benton Harbor when Pinckney made an attempt to recall a city commissioner. He was tried twice on that case, found innocent of charges in the first trial, but convicted in the second of illegally possessing 4 blank absentee ballots. Sentenced by the same judge, Pinckney ended up serving 7 months in the county jail and 4 months in prison of a 3 to 10 year sentence. During that time in jail, he ran for a seat in the U.S. House as a Green Party candidate. With the help of the American Civil Liberties Union, he was released on an appeal bond and returned home under house arrest, his conviction later overturned. Victoria Collier of the National Election Integrity Coalition writes about Pinckney's trial and sentence. "A country that can send a 66-year-old man to prison for up to 10 years on no evidence at all has slipped into fascism. When you stand up against the largest manufacturer of appliances in the world, of course there will be a backlash," said petition signer Allen, They will do anything to crush you if you stand up to them, adds Pinckney.
And so I think, you know, we can stop this now, or, you know, organize to stop this now, or it comes back and bites the rest of the American people, you know, at some point in the future. So really it's a future that's up to us. As I saw on the internet where Stephen Hawking, somebody asked him a question about what was his opinion of structural unemployment that was caused by automation. And the answer he gave was very interesting, because he said, well, you know, the outcome is going to be very difficult, where many, many, many people, the majority of us, are going to live in poverty, extreme poverty. And the people at the end of the other end of the pole are going to live in extreme wealth, you know. But, you know, it could be with, if machines and automation are producing all the things that people need, then, you know, everybody could live rich. You could end homelessness. You could end poverty. You know, but he says that the trend seems to be toward, you know, the people who own the machinery, like the Upton family of Whirlpool and the Whirlpools of the world. They're going to lobby to make sure that they control and hold on to all of that. And so, you know, with more of this technology that's introduced that seems to be, you know, labor-saving or labor-replacing technology, it's going to be more and more misery for people. So, you know, we have two possible outcomes, and it really depends on what people come to understand and come to realize and really want.
Do you think it would be effective to have a boycott of Whirlpool?
Well, people are you know, suggesting things like that. I think it may be. But, you know, what I would ask this question: if it's not a worldwide thing, what good would it really do? Because they're an international corporation. They're all over the world. I mean, they even got places in Italy, I understand.
Yeah.
I just found out. Yeah. And actually, they're laying off people in Italy.
Yeah, that's right.
They've got some of their. So it would have to be, it would have to be an international effort if you really wanted to make an impact. So I would say the number one thing is, for, if people are going to be able to challenge something like this, they have to know about it first. That's why it's so important, your show. And so important, this is basically a news blackout of all the stuff that goes on up there in Michigan in general, and in particular in Benton Harbor. It's awful. Reverend Pinckney is currently in Marquette Prison. They moved him way up there. They've taken away, you know, his phone privileges because he's been successful at getting the word out. And it's just an awful situation that he's in for a 67-year-old man.
Yes.
I understand his wife is telling me that the cell he was in had black mold and made him deathly ill. Yeah. Kill a man or what? What's going on?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think they feel like if they can put all this down on Reverend Pinckney, what they're really saying to everybody else is, this is what you get if you challenge us. You know, and then that with the silence, there's not much of a challenge you can get, as long as the challenge is just, you know, everybody sees it as just Reverend Pinckney. It's not that. It's Reverend Pinckney represents, you know, the little person out there. The little person has to get involved. But the little person has to hear about it first. And the only way they're going to hear about it is, you know, through radio shows like yours and the media taking an interest.
This week, Mayor Hightower was voted out of office in a landslide win for his opponent, a colleague of Pinckney's, Marcus Muhammad. He is a local fellow, a town commissioner, and a DePaul graduate. It's not yet known what effect his election may have on Pinckney's eventual release. During the preparation for the story, KBOO made an attempt to interview Reverend Pinckney through a phone call to the prison where he is incarcerated. Prison officials denied the request without explanation. This is Martin Watson Dodge, reporting for KBOO, Portland, Oregon.
And you are listening to KBOO, KBOO Portland. We go now to the second part of Political Perspectives for today. Christian Yount interviews Michael Gould Wartofsky about his new book, The Occupiers, The Making of the 99%. And be sure and stay tuned at 10 for Chris Andre hosting Air Cascadia. Thanks for tuning in to KBOO.
Thank you. This is Kristen Yount for KBOO Radio. I am here in the studio speaking with author of The Occupiers, The Making of the 99% Movement, Michael A. Gould-Wartofsky. Hi, Michael. How are you doing?
Good. It's good to be in Portland. Good to be at KBOO.
Yeah. Michael is going to be reading and signing the book on Wednesday, November 11th at 7 p.m. at the Q Center, which is at 4115 North Mississippi Avenue. This event's sponsored by KBOO and Reading Frenzy. This book is all about your observations during the Occupy movement, and talk about it.
So I was basically a native New Yorker who had seen and grown up with the everyday reality of inequality in my city, and was wondering when people were going to do something about it en masse, and was just a graduate student at the time who happened to go down on day one, had been inspired by the stories I had seen of the We Are the 99% project. People would write and scribe on cardboard signs stories of just horrific conditions that they had faced and grievances that they had not spoken or articulated or shared with anybody. And this was a moment when people kind of came out of their solitude and stood in a relationship of solidarity to one another. The first day, we didn't think it was going to last, and I didn't know that I was writing a book, but I just started taking notes every day at the park, doing some interviews and being a partisan and participant observer. And I was inspired by what I saw. I was also tried to bring a critical